You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education. It is Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. This is Lecture 4. Given in Dornach on the 26th of December, 1921. In trying to comprehend the world through a natural scientific interpretation of its phenomena, both from a cognitional and a practical point of view, people generally take into account conditions only as they meet them at the present time. Such a statement may appear incorrect to anyone who merely looks at the surface of things. However, as we proceed with our deliberations, it will become evident that this is indeed the case. We have grown accustomed to investigate the physical organism of man with the accepted methods of biology, physics, and anatomy, but though this may appear incorrect at first, in the results thus obtained, we are dealing only with what the present moment of time reveals to us. For example, we observe the lungs of a child, of an adult, and of an old person in their successive stages, from the beginning to the end of life, and we draw certain conclusions. But in this way we do not really penetrate the element of time at all, for we are limiting ourselves to observations in space. These, in turn, we invest with qualities of time. We are doing the same thing, to use a simile, when we read the time by looking at a clock. We note its hands, say in the morning, and their spatial positions indicate the time to us. We may look at the clock again at midday and conclude the passage of time from the spatial changes of its hands. We take our bearing as to the course of time from the movements of the hands from point to point in space. This has become our habitual way of judging time in everyday life. But in this way, we cannot experience the true nature of time. And yet, only by penetrating the element of time with the same awareness with which we experience space, can we rightly judge human life between birth and death. I should like to illustrate these theoretical remarks by examples which will show the importance of living oneself into the dimension of time, especially if one wishes to practice the art of education. Take, for example, a child who is full of reverence toward grown-up people. Anyone with a healthy instinct would consider such an attitude in a child as something wholesome, especially if such reverence is justified, as indeed it should be in the case of an adult. However, people usually think no further. They merely attribute such a feeling of reverence toward adults to certain characteristics of childhood and leave it at that. But one will never be able to recognize the importance of such reverence unless one includes the entire course of a human life in one's considerations. As one grows older, one may have the opportunity of observing old people. One may discover that some of them have the gift of bringing soul comfort to others who are in need of it. Often it is not the content of what such old people have to say which acts like balm on a suffering soul, but merely the tone of their voice or the way in which they speak. If now you trace back such an old person's life to his or her childhood days, you will find that as a child he or she was full of such reverence and respect for the adult. Naturally, this attitude of reverence will disappear in later life, but only on the surface. Deeper down, it will gradually become transformed, only to re-emerge later as the gift of bringing solace and elevation to suffering and troubled minds. One could also put it in this way. If a young child has learned to pray, if it has learned to develop an inner mood of prayer, this mood will enter the subconscious, there to undergo a metamorphosis, into the capacity of blessing in ripe old age. When we meet old people whose mere presence radiates blessing upon those around them, you will find that in their childhood they had experienced and developed such an inner mood of prayer. Such a transformation can only be discovered if one has learned to experience time as concretely as we are accustomed to experience space. We must learn to recognize the time element with the same awareness with which we experience space. Time must not be experienced in spatial terms only, as is the case when we look at a clock face. What I have been trying to illustrate with this example, regarding the moral aspects of life, needs to become very much part and parcel of our concept of man, certainly if a real art of education is to be developed. I should like to elaborate this point in greater detail. If we compare the human being with the animal, we find that from the moment of birth, animals, especially the higher species, are equipped with all the faculties necessary for their living. A chick leaving its shell does not need to learn to walk, for it is already adapted to its surroundings. Each animal's organs are firmly adapted to the specific needs of its species. This, however, is not at all the case with the human being, who comes into this world as a completely helpless creature. Only gradually can he develop the capacities and skills necessary for his life. And this is due to the fact that the most important period in his earthly life lies between the end of childhood and the coming of old age. This middle period, this time of maturity, is the most important feature of human life on earth. During that time, man adapts his organization to outer life by acquiring specific aptitudes and skills. He develops a reciprocal relationship to the outer world based on the range of his own experiences. This middle period, during which the human organs remain capable of evolving and adapting, is completely missing in the life of the animal. The animal is born into life in a state which fundamentally is comparable with that of the aged person whose organic forms have become rigid. If you wish to understand the animal's relationship to its surroundings, you must look upon it in terms of the human stage of old age. Now the question may arise, does the animal show characteristics of old age also with regard to its soul properties? This is not the case, because in the animal there also exists the opposite pole, which counteracts this falling into crabbed age, and that is its capacity for reproduction. The ability of procreation, be it in the human or animal kingdom, always engenders forces of rejuvenation. While, on the one hand, the animal falls prey to the influences of aging too rapidly, on the other, it is saved from premature aging through inflowing forces of reproduction until it reaches sexual maturity. If you are able to observe an animal or an animal species without preconception, you will come to the conclusion that at the time when the animal is capable of procreation, it has already reached the stage which is equivalent to that of old age in man. The characteristic difference in the case of the human being consists in the fact that both old age and childhood, during which the reproductive system in the latter is slowly maturing, are placed at either end of the human middle period, and that during this middle period, the flexibility of the human organism remains intact, thus enabling man to relate and adapt himself individually to outer conditions. By such an arrangement, the human being will be a child at the right time, leaving childhood at the appropriate age to enter the period of maturity. He will leave the age of maturity when the time comes for him to enter old age. If you look at human life from this time aspect, you can also understand certain abnormalities. You may come across individualities who, if I may put it this way, prematurely slip into old age. I am not so much thinking of obvious features generally associated with old age, such as gray hair or baldness, Even a bald head may have remained a childish person. I am thinking of more subtle symptoms, detectable only upon more intimate observations. One could call such features signs of a senile soul life, manifesting in a person already at a stage when he or she should still be living in the middle period of flexibility and adaptability. But the opposite may also happen. A person may be unable to leave the stage of childhood at the right time, carrying infantile features over into middle life. Then strange things may happen in the life of such a person, the symptoms of which we can only touch upon today. If we include the time element in our picture of man, we shall be able to diagnose various aberrations of human behavior. We know that as we approach old age, our head organization in particular loses inner mobility. Consequently, all the capacities which we have acquired during life attain more of a soul and spiritual quality. But this is only possible at the expense of the head organization, taking on certain animal-like properties. From a physical point of view, an old person undergoes conditions akin to those of a newborn animal. To a certain extent, he or she becomes animalized. In this way, provided their education was right, old people gain something which they may preserve for the rest of their lives. Their spiritual and soul experiences of the outer world no longer enter fully into their organization. The cranium has become so ossified and fixed. The aged person therefore depends more on soul and spiritual links with the surrounding world. He or she is no longer able to transform to the same extent outer happenings into inward qualities. Thereby a kind of animalization of the upper regions is taking place. Now, it is possible for such an animalization in the head organization to take place prematurely, that is, already during the middle period of life. But because a human being will remain human despite such a tendency toward animalization, we do not come across any outer symptoms. But we must become aware of certain changes within the realm of the soul. If the relationship to the outer world, characteristic of an aged person, establishes itself prematurely, and this can happen already during childhood, such a person's experiences will be drawn too much into the physical system, for, naturally, the general flexibility of the remaining human organization, typical of the younger age, still retains the upper hand. In this case, such a person will experience inwardly, but too early, what normally would result from a relationship to the outer world appropriate to old age. Communications between inner and outer world would be linked too much to the physical organization, thus bringing about properties of soul more akin to the animal world than would be the case in normal human beings. One could say, if one wished to express it in this way, that the animal has the advantage of a certain instinct over man. It is an instinct which links it more directly and more intimately to its surroundings than is the case in the normal human being. It is no mere myth, but absolutely accords with the peculiarities of animal life, that certain animals leave localities which are in danger of impending natural catastrophes. Regarding the self-preservation of life, animals are gifted with certain prophetic instincts. It is also correct to state that the animal experiences far more intensely the changing seasons than man does. It is able to sense the approach of the time when it has to migrate to other regions, for it has such an intimate and instinctive relationship to its surroundings. If one could look into an animal's soul life, one would find there, albeit entirely unconsciously, an instinctive wisdom of life, manifesting in the animals entirely living within the manifold processes and forces of nature. Now, if a person falls victim to encroaching age too early, such an animal-like instinctive experience of the surroundings begins to develop, naturally in sublimated form, because in a human being everything is lifted into the human sphere. In what today is known as lower forms of clairvoyance, as telepathy, telekinesis, and so forth, often described correctly and often quite wrongly, these faculties, which occur abnormally in human life, are nothing but the result of such premature aging playing into the middle period of life. If the process of aging occurs at the right time, one will experience it in a healthy manner, whereas if it already makes its appearance in one's 20s, one becomes a clairvoyant of a low order. Symptoms of a premature aging represent an abnormality in life which does not reveal itself outwardly, but in a more hidden manner. If these forms of lower clairvoyance were to be studied from the aspect of man's premature aging, a far deeper insight into these phenomena could be achieved. This, however, is only possible if one observes life in a more realistic way. It is not good enough merely to investigate what one can see before one's eyes at the present moment of time. One must learn to recognize in these symptoms indications of a time shift from later to earlier stages of life. We shall see in the next few days how healing processes can come about through an exact insight into human nature. It is indeed possible that a kind of animalization of man could be manifested not in an outwardly visible aging process, but rather in that a close and instinctive relationship with the environment can encroach upon the lower regions of man, otherwise characteristic of the animal. The resulting phenomena of telepathy, telekinesis, and so on do not lose in interest by being recognized for what they really are, namely, not manifestations of the spiritual world, but the intrusion of a later stage of life upon an earlier. By developing a time consciousness, one is able to fathom the very depths of human nature. To live in the dimension of time is to survey the course of time until one is able to see into both past and future from the present moment of time. You will yourself feel how actually our present day observation, even though it may appear outwardly otherwise, is very remote from this more inward means of observation, which is more concurrent with time and its course. Insufficient interpretations of what meets us in life result from present-day observation. Contemporary scientific explanations and their effects upon life are full of such insufficient interpretations. Looking at the course of human life, we find that the reverse case of what has here been described is also possible. Childishness is carried over into the age of maturity. It is characteristic of the child that it not only experiences the external world less consciously than grown-up people, but also that its experiences are much more intimately bound up with metabolic changes. If a child sees colors, their impressions strongly affect its metabolic processes. The child takes in outer sense impressions right down into its metabolism. It is no mere metaphor to speak of a child digesting its sense impressions, for its digestion responds to all its outer experiences. An aged person develops certain animal characteristics within the physical, but the child's entire life is filled with a sensitivity toward the vegetative, organic processes, which also affect the child's life of soul. Unless we are aware of this fact, we shall not be able to understand the child's nature. In later years, man leaves the digestive metabolic processes more to themselves. He experiences the external world more independently of them. He does not allow his soul and spiritual reactions to the outer world to affect his metabolism to the extent that a child does. His response to his surroundings is not accompanied by the same lively activity of glandular secretion as in the case of the child. The child takes in all outer impressions as if they were edible substances, but the adult leaves his digestion to itself, and this fact alone makes him into an adult under normal circumstances. But there are cases where the vegetative organic forces, which work in a legitimate way during childhood, still continue to work in an adult, affecting also his psyche. Then other abnormal symptoms are liable to occur. An example will make this clear. Suppose, for instance, someone develops a love for a dog which makes a deep impression on his nature. If he or she is one who has carried childishness over into later life, this tenderness will work right into the metabolism. Organic processes corresponding to his feelings of affection will be set up. In such a case, digestive processes take place not only after the intake of food or as a result of normal physical activities, but certain areas within the digestive system will develop a habit of secreting and regenerating substances in response to the strong emotions evoked by the love for such an animal. The dog will become indispensable to the well-being of such a person's vegetative system. What happens if the dog dies? The connection in outer life is broken off. The organic processes go on by force of inertia, but they are no longer satisfied. The person's feelings miss something they had got used to, and in an inward way trouble ensues. Let me read that sentence again. The person's feelings miss something they had got used to, and an inward trouble ensues. The strangest disturbances may occur. A friend may advise the buying of a new dog and so restore the previous dog owner to health. For now the inner organic processes can find satisfaction again through external experiences. We shall see later that there are better ways of curing such an abnormality, but anyone may reasonably try to solve the problem in this way. There are, of course, many other examples to be found, less drastic than such a deep affection for a dog. If an adult has not outgrown certain forces of childhood, destined to absorb external impressions within the digestive system, and if he or she no longer can satisfy this abnormal habit, certain cravings within the vegetative organism will result. But there are also other things which may have been loved and then lost and which cannot be replaced. Then the individual concerned remains dissatisfied, morose, and hypochondriacal. One must try to find the true causes of apparently inexplicable symptoms arising from the depths of the unconscious. There are people who can sense what needs to be done to alleviate the suffering caused by unsatisfied emotions, which affect inner organic processes. They manage to coax out and to bring to consciousness what the patient desires to call to mind, and in this way they are able to help a great deal. Due to the present state of our civilization, there are many people who have not progressed from childhood to adulthood in the normal way, and consequently the ensuing symptoms, both light and serious, have been noticed far and wide. While in ordinary life this naturally led to conversations among helpful and interested people, the situation has stimulated, and in many respects, quite rightly so, scientific psychological research. A new scientific terminology sprang up. The patient's psyche was examined through investigation into dreams or by free or involuntary giving of oneself away. In this way, unfulfilled urges were raised from the subconscious into consciousness. This new branch of science was called psychology or psychoanalysis, the science of probing into the hidden regions of the soul. However, we are not dealing with, quote, hidden regions of the soul, close quote, but with the remains of vegetative organic processes, which have been left behind and which crave satisfaction. When such thwarted desires have been diagnosed, one can help the patients to readapt themselves. And herein lies what is valuable in psychoanalysis. When judging such matters, anthroposophy finds itself in a difficult position. It has no wish to quarrel with the findings of natural science. On the contrary, anthroposophy is very ready to recognize and to accept anything which remains within its proper and justifiable realm. In this way, anthroposophy also accepts psychoanalysis within its proper bounds. But anthroposophy endeavors to see all problems and questions within the widest context, encompassing the entire universe and the entire being of man. It feels compelled to widen the arbitrary restrictions laid down by natural science, which often carries out its investigations in quite an unprofessional and dilettantish way, even today. Anthroposophy has no wish and no intention to quarrel. It only puts into a wider perspective what is declared in a one-sided manner. Yet, such a way of working is distasteful and unacceptable to anyone who prefers to wear blinders, and consequently furious attacks are being made upon anthroposophy. Anthroposophy has to defend itself against a one-sided attitude, but it will never be aggressive. This has to be said regarding present-day currents of thought, such as we find in psychoanalysis. It is important that we distinguish between two polarized situations. Either a person draws the last period of life too much into middle age, and consequently abnormal relationships with the external world develop, manifesting as lower forms of clairvoyance, such as telepathy. In this case, such a person extends his horizon beyond the normal human scope in an animal-like fashion. Or a person may move in the opposite direction by pushing into later periods of life what rightly belongs only to childhood. In consequence, he becomes enmeshed too strongly with his physical organism, with the result that organic surges swamp his psyche, causing disturbances and inner abnormalities. Such a person suffers from a too close relationship with his own organic system. This latter relationship has been diagnosed by psychoanalysis, which, however, ought to direct its attention to human organology in order to grasp the roots of the problem. If we wish to reach a comprehensive knowledge of man, it is absolutely necessary to include in our considerations the entire course of human life between birth and death. It is essential to focus one's attention upon the effects of the passing of time and inwardly to live with them and to experience them. Anthroposophy, which pursues knowledge of man in his totality by penetrating into the supersensible through its own specific methods, therefore fully takes into account the time element, which in the present stage of our civilization is generally completely ignored. Imagination, inspiration, and intuition, which are the specific methods of anthroposophical endeavor, must be built upon an experience of the element of time. Imagination, inspiration, and intuition, the ways leading to supersensible cognition, could not be looked upon as faculties lying outside ordinary human life, but rather as a continuation, an extension of ordinary human capacities. Anthroposophy dismisses the prejudice which holds that only through some special grace can we attain this kind of cognition. But it maintains that man is able to become conscious of certain faculties lying deep within him and to have the power to train them. The usual kind of knowledge gained through contemporary scientific training and in ordinary practical life certainly must be transcended. What happens when we try to comprehend the world around us, not as scientifically trained specialists, but as ordinary people? We are surrounded by colors, sounds, by varying degrees of warmth, and so on. All of which I should like to call the tapestry of the sense world. We surrender ourselves to these sense impressions, and weave them together without thoughts. If you think about the nature of memories rising up in your soul, you will find that they are the result of sense impressions woven into our thoughts. Our whole life depends on our imparting this texture of sense impressions and thoughts to our life of soul. But what is it that really happens? Look at the diagram, and there's a drawing. Let the line A to B represent the tapestry of the sense world, which surrounds us, consisting of colors, sounds, smells, etc. We give ourselves up to our observation, to this tapestry of the senses, and weave its impressions together with our thinking, here indicated by the wavy line. When living in his senses, man unites all his experiences with his thoughts. He interprets the sense stimuli through his thinking. But when thus projecting his thoughts into his surroundings, this tapestry becomes for him a barrier, a metaphorical canvas upon which he draws and paints all his thoughts, but which he is unable to penetrate. He cannot break through this incorporeal wall with his present-day ordinary consciousness. As they are being stopped by this canvas, his thoughts inscribe themselves upon it. The only possibility of penetrating this wall is gained by raising one's consciousness to the state of imagination through systematic and regular meditation exercises. It is equally possible to undergo an inner training in meditation as a method of research in an outwardly directed study of chemistry or astronomy. If you read my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, and the second part of title Occult Science, also known as Reader's Aside, An Outline of Esoteric Science, End of Reader's Aside, you can convince yourselves that if one wishes to reach the final goal, the methods employed for such meditative exercises are by no means simple and less time-consuming than those needed to acquire knowledge of astronomy or chemistry. On the other hand, it is comparatively easy to read books giving information about such exercises and using one's common sense to be able to examine the truths of anthroposophical research. These do not have to be taken on authority. Even if one is not able to make investigations into the spiritual world oneself, it is possible to test given results by studying the specific methods employed. Meditative practice rests on our freeing ourselves from outer sense impressions. In meditation, we do not surrender ourselves to sense impressions, but only to the life of thoughts. However, by dwelling again and again in meditation on a given thought or mental image, one that is easily and fully comprehensible, we gradually bring our life of thought to such a strength and inner substance that we are able to move in it with the same certainty as in our sense impressions. You will all have experienced the difference between the striking effects of outer sense impressions and the rather limp and pale world of our thoughts during ordinary consciousness. Sense impressions are intensive and alive. We give ourselves up to them. Thoughts, on the other hand, turn pale. They become abstract and cold. But the very core of meditating consists in our becoming able, through regular practice, to imbue our thoughts with the same intensity and liveliness with which we normally experience our sense life. If we succeed in grasping a meditation content with the same inward intensity with which we usually grasp the stimulus of a color, then we have brought to life, in the right way, the underlying thoughts of a meditation. But all this has to happen with the same inner freedom as the normal weaving of thoughts or as ordinary sense perceptions. Just as we do not allow ourselves to be taken over by nebulous moods or mystical dreaming, or become fatuous visionaries when observing the external world, so must we not lose firm ground when meditating in the right way. The same sane mood with which we perceive the world around us must hold sway also when we meditate. This attitude of taking outer sense perceptions as an example for one's conduct when meditating is characteristic of the anthroposophical method. There are plenty of nebulous mystics who look down upon sense perception as something inferior, which ought to be left behind. They proclaim that the meditant should reach a state of mystic dreaming. The result, naturally, is a state of semi-sleep, but not of real meditating. Anthroposophy pursues the opposite aim. It considers the quality, intensity, and liveliness of sense perception as an example to be followed until the meditant inwardly moves with the same freedom with which he encounters sense perceptions. He need have no fears of ending up as a dry Philistine. The content which he objectively experiences in his meditative practice will save him from that. When meditating, there is no need for him to enter trance-like nebulous states. Because of the inner content which he experiences, while thus freeing himself from workaday life. Through rightful meditation, one can achieve the ability of moving freely in one's life of thinking. This, in turn, redeems the thoughts from their previous abstract character. They become image-like. And this happens in full waking consciousness, just as any healthy thinking does. It is essential never to lose full consciousness, and this is what distinguishes meditating from any hallucinatory state. Anyone given up to hallucinations, any futile enthusiast or visionary, relinquishes his sound common sense, whereas anyone wanting to follow the methods here advocated must ensure that sound common sense accompanies him in all his weaving of thought pictures. And what is the result? Though fully awake, he will experience the pictorial quality of the dream world. The significant difference between imagination and dream pictures lies in that we are completely passive when receiving the latter. If they rise from the subconscious to enter our waking state, we can observe them only after they have happened. When practicing imagination, on the other hand, we ourselves are the initiators. We create images which are no mere fancy, but which differ in their intensity and strength from the fanciful, as much as the dream pictures do. The main point is that it is we ourselves who initiate the images, and this frees us from the illusion that they are a manifestation of the external world. Anyone given up to hallucinations always believes that what comes to him represents reality, because he is aware of not having been the creator of what he sees. In this lies the cause of the deception. Whoever practices imagination through meditating cannot possibly be under the impression that the images he creates represent outer reality. The first step toward supersensible cognition depends on one's freeing oneself from the illusion that the images one has created, images which are of the same intensity as those of the dream world, are real. This, however, is self-evident, because the meditant is fully aware of having initiated them in complete freedom. Only a madman would mistake them for outer reality. Now the next step in meditation consists of acquiring the ability of letting these images vanish without a trace. This is not as easy as one might expect, because unless the meditant has created them in full freedom, such images become quite fascinating, fixing themselves on the mind like parasites. One has to gain the strength to let such pictures disappear at will. This second step is of equal importance to the first. Just as, in ordinary life, we need to be able to forget, as otherwise we would always have to walk about with the sum total of all our memories, so the total extinction of all these images is as important as their creation in the first place. When one has thoroughly practiced these exercises, one has done something to one's soul life, which could be compared with the strengthening of a muscle through repeated bending and stretching. By learning to weave and form images, and then again to obliterate them, and all this out of an entirely free will activity, one has performed an important training of the soul. One has developed the faculty of consciously forming images, which under normal circumstances only appear in dreams, that is, during a condition which escapes our ordinary consciousness, and which is confined to the time between falling asleep and waking. But now this condition has been induced both consciously and in full freedom. Training in imagination is to train the will, consciously to create images as well as consciously to remove them from the mind. And through this activity, we acquire yet another faculty. Everyone has this faculty involuntarily, not during sleep, but at the moment of waking and of falling asleep. It is possible that what was experienced between these two moments comes over to us as remnants of dreams, often felt to come from the beyond. Naturally, it is equally possible that what we meet on waking up so surprises us that all memories of dreams sink below the threshold of consciousness. In general, one can say that because dream imaginations are experienced involuntarily, something chaotic, something erratic, which normally lies beyond our consciousness, finds its way to us. If, while fully awake, one develops the ability of creating and obliterating imaginations, one can reach a condition of emptied consciousness. This is like a new awakening. And then from beyond the tapestry of the sense world, spiritual entities pass through the tapestry to reach us on paths smoothed by the meditation content. And there's a diagram. While thus persevering in emptied consciousness, we push through the senses barrier and images. Inspiration born come to us from beyond the sense world. We enter the world which lies beyond the sense world. Through imagination, we prepare ourselves for inspiration, which consists in our being able to experience consciously something which happens unconsciously at the moment of waking. Just as at the moment of waking, something from beyond our waking soul life enters our consciousness, so something lying beyond the consciousness of the sense world enters us if through imagination we have trained our soul life in the way described. In this way, we experience the spiritual world lying beyond the world of the senses. Faculties of supersensible cognition are an extension of those naturally given to man in his ordinary life. It is one of the main tasks of anthroposophy to train and to foster the development of these higher faculties. The grasping of the time element in the course of human life is fundamental to any such higher development. If you look up the preparatory exercises for imagination, inspiration, and intuition, as given in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, or in my title Occult Science, you will find that all that is stated there aims at one thing, namely, at the development of the ability to experience the course of time. The human being goes through the various stages of experience in the world, first as a child, then as a mature person, and finally as an old person. Or he may suffer from an abnormal overlap of one stage into the other. It is not imagination in itself, but the meditative preparation toward it, which should give man the possibility of developing his full potential and of learning how to give himself to the world out of the fullness of his life. To this end, harmony must be brought about between the specific contributions to the world of childhood, middle age, and of old age. These must flow together harmoniously into a world outlook capable of reaching the spiritual world. Man in his wholeness, which includes also the domain of time, must be actively engaged in his work in the world. In order to achieve a world outlook which reaches beyond the barriers of the sense world, the human being must preserve the freshness of experience which is proper to youth, the clarity of thought and the freedom of judgment proper to middle age, and the power of loving devotion to life, which can reach its perfection in old age. All these qualities are a necessary preparation for the right development of imagination, inspiration, and intuition. The end of Lecture 4.